Bygma er officiel partner af Team Visma, Lisa Bike og Jonas Vingegaard. Og sammen med Airtox har vi under turen skarpe priser på de populære letvægt sikkerhedssko fra Airtox, samt konkurrencer i butikken. Kom ned i din lokale Bygma. Bygma. Ikke for amatører.
Det er tid til at gå bag om facaden. Yeah! Velkommen til Behind the Vinyl med Darren Edwards og Niklas Müller. My Rock.
And we're back. This is Darren and Nicholas, and we're with Behind the Vinyl on Pyro Rock Radio. This week we're talking about the biggest debut album of all time, and probably one of the greatest debut albums of all time.
It is.
Guns N' Roses, Appetite for Destruction. This is an album that we actually said, let's not do that for a while because it's such an obvious choice for something like this, that and Metallica's Black Album.
Right.
But you know what? It just needs to be done, or it's good to be done because it's a fucking great record, man.
It is.
And there's lots of little bits and bobs from the outcome of it.
There is.
It's a record that sold 40 million copies or something.
Which is nuts.
Unbelievable.
But yeah, that is, I think, one of those albums that had a profound impact on me when it came to music, so on. That one and like Back in Black with AC/DC, or Van Halen's first one, Motley Crue's Shout at the Devil, Appetite for Destruction, still as good today. I'm still as fascinated today with that album as I was back then.
I can remember this album stopping me. I was super young, like maybe 13 or 14 or something like that when it came out. But I can remember this was stopping me going to parties at night because we had MTV.
Yeah.
And there was like, you know, hey, they're going to play some Guns N' Roses
right.
stuff, you know. Yeah, they had the videos. They also had Live at the Roxy back then.
Yeah.
They had interviews. So if there was a chance of Guns N' Roses being on MTV, and we had this show in Australia called Rage.
Right.
It started at midnight. So if there was a chance of Guns N' Roses, I wouldn't go to the party. You know, everyone would be like, fuck, let's go out. I'd be like, I'm staying home.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had that much effect. And we talked about when we did the Bon Jovi Behind the Vinyl for Slippery When Wet, that had a very, like, it was like Beatlemania.
Yes.
All over again for Bon Jovi. And I think that was tenfold, but in a different way for Guns N' Roses. I think it was like the second coming. It was like, holy shit, this is the real deal. This is as true as our generation will get.
Yeah.
This was our, like, to me, Led Zeppelin or Black Sabbath are just
yes.
through and through true, you know? And I think Guns N' Roses were just through and through just true. There was everyone that saw them. I know last week we talked about Poison.
Yeah.
And you were saying the producer just went to the show with Poison, to the Guns N' Roses show, and said, no matter what you do, how many records you'll sell, you'll never be as good as these guys. And I think everyone had that feeling.
Yeah. I think a funny thing that a friend of mine came up with, like, he came up with this idea just about a year ago, where it's always said that grunge killed the whole Sunset Strip thing. And his theory is that Appetite for Destruction kind of killed it. Because Appetite for Destruction was so more real. It was, you know, it was more dirty, gritty. The stuff they sang about was different from what Quiet Riot and Rat and Motley Crue and all those bands did. I mean, Motley Crue sang about, you know, drugs and so on, but in a different way.
Absolutely.
Guns N' Roses, they were in that whole thing. They were living in the streets, trying to make ends meet in every possible way, and nothing was ever the same after that album. And then after that album, that whole scene kind of started dying out. You had all these one-hit wonders that the major labels try to sign that got one album and then they disappeared. Then later on, early 90s, grunge came along and totally killed it. But I think it makes sense in a way that we didn't have lyrics. I'm thinking like My Michelle and stuff like that.
Yeah.
There were no no such thing before that.
Klassikere under loop. Behind the vinyl på My Rock.
Bye.
It was a gritty record.
Yeah.
And like, well, everyone knows about the side A and side B story.
Yeah.
You know, on Guns N' Roses, it's side G and side R.
Yeah.
And the side G being the rougher, heavier,
yes,
you know, more violent, you know, Welcome to the Jungle.
Yeah.
How to get me in, you know, I've just drawn a blank of the track listing for the record, you know. But yeah, like Welcome to the Jungle, It's So Easy, Night Train, Out to Get Me, Mr. Brownstone,
yeah,
you know, stuff like that, more aggressive, while yep. side B is more the love songs,
yep.
you know, the you know, the yeah, the more love songs, the more gentle songs,
you yeah know? But also you had that album cover, which was also, I mean, that there'd been album covers before that were controversial and so on, and going back, you had like in 1983-84 you had Wasp with the Meat and all that stuff, and you know, cutting a woman on stage and all that, but that album cover was different as well.
It was different as well, but it goes back to what you were saying, like I think there was, things were contrived, you know, and things were manipulated, yep. and put on,
yep.
And Guns N' Roses was the real fucking deal. Axl Rose was as real as it gets.
Yeah.
You know?
Nutcase.
A nutcase.
Yeah.
You know? And there's few bands that have ever been as full on as that.
Yeah,
know?
No. No. They were one of a kind, most definitely. And a funny thing was that that's also something that's funny with music and stuff, that now, Matt, no matter how nerdy you are, you always find out new things.
Right, yeah.
And I remember you turned me on to Dean Del Rey.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Let There Be Talk, his podcast, where he does a lot of cool people. And he's done like one or two interviews with Duff McKagan. And Duff McKagan said, and I listened to this last summer, Duff McKagan said that one of the initial ideas for the album cover was a picture of the Challenger.
Yeah, yeah.
The space shuttle explosion. But
which Time magazine used, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. I'd never heard that before. That was new for me.
I'd never heard that before, but since then, I've heard it three or four times.
Oh, okay.
Axl Rose has also said it in an interview as well.
Oh, okay.
So
cool.
And one thing I didn't know, they reissued the record like in 2008. They reissued Appetite for Destruction, as well as this new one.
Yeah.
But they reissued again in 2008.
Right, yeah.
I didn't realize that they were going to then use the the Robert Williams.
Oh.
Cover.
All right.
Yeah, for the reissues.
Okay.
But at the last minute, at the 11th hour, kind of like they did for, you know, for its debut release, they pulled out and just ran it as a straight reissue.
Yeah. That's fascinating.
It's fascinating, yeah. Absolutely.
It's fascinating how it still can be, how it can still be controversial in this day and age, after all this time.
I think people are getting more conservative. The sex and the women, that can't really happen now.
No,
like
Jesus.
It happened in the 80s.
No,
the drug use, the excessive drug use, and the being tolerant of a band like Guns N' Roses or a band like Motley Crue.
Yep.
I tell you right now, it would never fucking happen.
No.
They could never walk into my office and,
no,
and act like that.
Absolutely not, no.
But then they could.
Yeah.
Why was that the case?
Yeah. Fascinating in so many different ways. Yeah, I don't know. Different times for sure. And they really put a stamp on it with that attitude.
Behind the Vinyl, My Rock.
On a side note, Nitrone, everyone knows it's a drink. It's like a really cheap wine that Guns N' Roses used to drink. Guns N' Roses used to buy it from the shop on Sunset.
Right.
Right. This one particular shop, because that's where they kind of lived, or all their stripper friends would live around there. So they go to this one particular shitty, rundown alcohol kind of tobacco shop.
Yeah.
And Nitrone isn't really that popular because it's death in a bottle.
Yeah.
But they still have it at that shop.
Oh, cool.
So I went and bought a couple of bottles of Nitrone when I was in LA a couple of years ago.
Nice.
And this obvious born and bred and lived a hard life LA person.
Yeah.
He was probably about 60 years old or something, but possibly a street guy, that, like, lived in the street. He walked in when I was at the counter and he looked at me and he looked at the Nitrone and then he looked at the cashier and he goes, get him some Panadol as well.
Nice.
True story.
Nice. Of course.
Yeah.
Guns and fucking Roses.
So Guns N' Roses, right? You know, I don't know, really want to go into how the band come together because everyone knows that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of connection, you know, with previous bands like Road Crew. Both Duff and Steven and Slash were in the band.
Yeah, you had Hollywood Rose with Tracy Guns.
Tracy Guns, who was in Guns N' Roses before he left and was replaced by Slash. He just didn't show up one day.
Right,
literally just didn't show up. He got fed up with Axl, I think, and just didn't show up. And then there was also London, the band London, who Izzy Stradlin was in London.
He was?
Izzy Stradlin was in London, yeah.
Huh.
Nicky Six was in London,
seems
of course.
Like everybody was in London.
That was the band.
Yeah.
That was the band in LA. London, Nicky was in there. Blackie Lawless was in there. Izzy Stradlin was in there.
Huh.
Slash and Steven Adler tried out for London but didn't make it.
All right, cool.
Yeah, and that's why they started Road Crew.
Right, yeah. Nice. Yeah. No, but it is a fantastic album, but also again, I think those lyrics in all of those songs were something totally different from the whole party glam kind of lipstick and leather kind of scene. And they also looked, I mean, they had more of that Hanoi Rocks kind of thing. They looked like they came off the street. They looked kind of dirty and, you know, like they'd been around for a while.
Yeah. Well, again, probably everyone knows this, but although they lived on the street, you know, and they lived in the rehearsal space and they had no money, and especially Axl and Izzy, and they were living off strippers.
Yep.
Slash and Steven were more... Even though Slash is born in
London
or outside Stoke on Trent, they had some bases. They had family in there. Slash actually come from a good family.
Yeah,
of an art designer father and a fashion designer mother who used to date David Bowie
and
and make clothes for all of all of the music stars. He was actually friends with David Geffen.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
You've heard the, I don't know whether everyone's heard the Christmas card story.
No, not that one.
Well, David Geffen sent Slash's mum a Christmas card because he used to be good friends with Slash's mum and, and you know, she'd do a lot of work for his artists. So she sent him a Christmas card and said, oh, I hope you're doing well, Merry Christmas, all that kind of stuff. And she wrote back to him and said, you know, really nice to hear from you. He actually signed my son, you know, and I understand his band is doing quite well. And David Geffen was like, who's your son?
Yeah.
And she had to explain it was Slash from Guns N' Roses. The album was basically flopping.
Yep.
It was seven months in. It had sold 200,000 copies, which is not a great deal. They paid what was it, $375,000 to make that record, which is not a lot of money.
Right.
So $375,000 plus an extra $75,000, which is not a lot of money, advance
for the
to
band.
Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's not a lot of money, though.
No.
Obviously, they had promotion and all this kind of stuff, but they're not overly invested, but
no.
They were expecting a lot. This is a band everyone wanted.
Yeah.
This is Tom Zuant, who signed Motley Crue, for instance.
Exactly.
He signed Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
And I think it's pretty legendary. He walked in. He didn't even stay for two songs.
Exactly.
He saw like one song and realized, fuck, this is...
Yeah.
This is, you know, the band of...
Yeah.
This is the greatest band that will ever be.
Yeah.
And he went to Geffen Records the next day where he worked and said, this is the greatest band.
Yeah, didn't he also... He walked out from the club and then kind of on his way out, he told all the other guys from the record label, this is pure shit.
Right, yeah, I think so. Because there was something like six or eight other record labels there.
Exactly.
Because these guys were the hot band.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hot band.
Yeah.
But it goes back to the fact the album was stalling.
Yeah.
You know, and it makes you wonder, how many other records like this? I could name some, you know.
Faster Pussycat came out same year.
Right, yeah. But I mean albums that should be the biggest albums of all time.
Mm.
Like, this is only personal opinion, but Jeff Buckley, Grace.
Oh.
You know, a phenomenal record.
Yeah.
I think one of the greatest records outside of rock, outside of metal.
Yep.
Absolutely phenomenal record.
Yes.
It didn't really do that good.
No.
It's cult following.
Yeah, today it is.
But it didn't really sell that great.
No.
And it's kind of weird why some records just don't really...
Especially if you look at, like we said last time with Poison, who had a major success with Look What the Cat Dragged In, the first album. And then you have Guns N' Roses with Appetite for Destruction with just hit song after hit song on that album. And still, it took about... I mean, it was released in 1987. It took until, I guess, 1988 or something before it really exploded in the U.S. and then the rest of the world, which is really weird. Because people must have still, you know, since, you know, 200,000, 300,000 people bought it, and they must have loved it. And still nothing really happened until MTV.
So the MTV story, everyone knows, so let's not go into this too much. The label was going to not drop the band, but they were going to like cut their losses, stop working, move on, which would have meant the death of the record.
Yes.
Tom Zuant didn't accept it, goes into David Geffen's office himself. And actually, I saw a little interview with him where he talks about David Geffen being on the phone and David Geffen hanging up the phone and going, have you seen this? Where he says, what are you doing in my office without a meeting?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which I thought was fucking classic. So he said, hey, they're gonna kill the record. Whoever's the person running your label is going to kill this record. I need a favor.
Yeah.
We need to do something. And so David Geffen rung up MTV, who had sworn that they weren't going to play this record because they were a bunch of drug addicts and like misfits and all this kind of stuff.
And, oh, yeah.
And there was a guy, I'm just kind of looking for his name now. There was a guy who basically owned the majority of the networks, which MTV,
the cable
platforms. And he was the one that said it was never, if you were going to play this band, how he knew about Guns N' Roses, I don't know.
No.
But he would kick MTV off their platform, which basically would kill MTV.
Okay, wow.
But somehow David Geffen called in a favor and he got the song played once on a Sunday night.
Yes.
Sunday stroke Monday.
Yeah.
You know? So effectively Monday morning, 4 a.m. New York time, 1 a.m. LA time. And legend has it that they received so many calls that the switchboard caught fire.
Yeah.
Have you heard that story?
Yeah.
Physically, supposedly there's a little spark or something.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, whenever a call comes through.
Yeah.
And there was 10,000 simultaneous calls that caused it to physically ignite.
Yeah.
and the next Monday.
So the story begins.
Next Monday they added it.
Yeah.
And within a week they'd sold double the amount of records.
Yeah. I interviewed Nigel Dick, who did all their first videos. British guy who also did Do They Know It's Christmas. He did that video, the Band-Aid video. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And he said that Welcome to the Jungle cost around $80,000 to $90,000 around that time. The story of the video came from Alan Niven. He was inspired by the movies Midnight Cowboy, A Clockwork Orange, and The Man Who Fell to Earth, the David Bowie movie. Yeah. Nigel also said that, yeah, Alan Niven gave me the story, for example, where Axel, he sits in a chair, tries to get out of it, it's an electric chair, whatever it is. That idea came from A Clockwork Orange. He also said that, yeah, there were some problems working with the band early on, and it was all about waiting for Axl.
Well, yeah, I think that story has always been the case. Like, yeah. They ended up settling on Mike Klink to produce the record.
Yep.
But they jumped around in between producers for pre-production. I think the most famous story is Spencer Proffer, I think his name is, who did Quiet Riot's Mental Health. Yep. Had a massive hit. He also worked with Hard and Cheap Trick and Wasp and Ian Hunter and stuff like that. So the story goes that he was recording the record and he was about to have his first kid, and he kind of told the band he was having his first kid by cesarean section.
Oh, okay.
So he told the band, hey, on Friday, we're having cesarean at the night time. So I'd like to leave at 5 o'clock. So can you get in here at 12 in the daytime and I'll give you 5 hours, but then I want to go to the hospital, for the birth of my kid. Yeah. And the band all agreed. Come Friday, they didn't show up. And so they all showed up really, really late. And supposedly Axl walked in and threw up on the mixing desk, and Slash come in and couldn't wait to go to the toilet, so he just pissed on the wall. and he was like, fuck you guys, I'm out of here.
Yeah.
And he gave back his points for the record and sold them for a cheap amount of money, back the material that he'd recorded.
All right.
Behind the Vinyl. Behind the Vinyl. Med Darren Edwards og Niklas Müller. My Rock.
Paul Stanley was in the mix for a while.
Mr. Stanley Eisen was in there, yes.
Exactly, yeah. Which didn't end too well.
I could never see him
producing that kind of record, or
I can't see him
producing anything outside of Kiss, to be honest with you.
No, and I couldn't see him working with those guys.
No.
He's this healthy...
and these guys were just guy. Like, it was them and no one else.
Yeah.
But also they worked with Manny Charlton.
From Nazareth, yeah.
Now, I'm kicking myself.
They did some demos with him.
Yeah, because in the early 2000s, I was out to dinner with Manny Charlton.
Oh, right, yeah.
And we talked about a lot of things.
Yeah.
We never talked about Guns N' Roses. And I've kicked myself ever since. Like, I don't know why it never come up.
Yeah.
Maybe it did.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to talk about it.
No.
I don't know, but I can remember that. Fuck, how did that...
Yeah, because I had him, because I did two stories for when Guns N' Roses played here last time. Was it 2017?
Yeah.
I did a story with Vicky Hamilton, who was like the first manager for Guns N' Roses.
Absolutely, and who let the guy sleep on a sofa.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I did a story and an interview with Nigel Dick, the video director for Sweden Rock magazine. And I was in touch with Manny Charlton, who said, sure, interview, blah, blah, blah. And then nothing happened. Didn't get back to me. And I was also in touch with Tom Suthart. I found it on Facebook.
Oh, really?
And he said, yeah, interview? Sure, absolutely. And then I tried contacting him. Nothing happened. So, but, yeah, Manny was in there. And those demos, they've been out there for a while. You can find them on YouTube. I don't know if those demos are part of the new deluxe box thing, whatever. Can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was also mixed by Steve Thompson and Michael Barbaro.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And they were in line to produce it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they didn't want to, or they...
No, and the thing with Mike Klink, because Mike Klink had done, like, Triumph, I think, the Canadian band before. He wasn't really a hotshot producer.
No, but he'd done UFO.
That was the reason. Exactly.
That was the reason. Why.
That was the reason. Yes, yeah. yes, of course.
And Axl loved UFO.
Yeah.
So that was the reason why Mike Klink, and I think he kind of understood the guys a little bit better.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Mike Klink also started doing A Justice for All.
Of course he did, but it didn't work out.
It didn't work out. So they went back to Fleming.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fair and he also did Rust in Peace.
Oh, he did?
Yeah.
All right.
So,
cool.
Negative.
He became a hotshot.
He became a hotshot. Where he is now, I have no idea.
I tried to reach out to him.
Yeah?
But it just came back. The email came back. Inbox is full.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Strangers in the Night is the UFO album that
Right. Which is also one of those live albums that is considered to be a kind of fake.
Right, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Which is Live Like a Suicide.
Yeah,
you know, Guns N' Roses.
Definitely. You
know, which is not even like pretending to be a fake.
No, the audience, the sound of the audience was taken from. It's one of those jams.
Right.
California Jam or Texas Jam or whatever it is.
That.
Yeah, they stole it from there.
I get up around 7, get out of bed around 9, and I don't worry about nothing, no, because worrying's a waste of my time. So usually starts around 7, we go on stage around 9, get on the bus about 11, sipping a drink.
I think that if people haven't read or checked out the book Reckless Road, that is a fantastic book about the early days of Guns N' Roses in L.A., about almost every single show they played at, the Roxy, the Troubadour, the Whiskey A Go-Go, all that.
In the early years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Written by Mark Cantor.
Which was Slash's best friend.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Who's a trippy little chap.
Yeah,
but his family own
Cantor's
Deli.
Yeah.
Yeah, which again, I didn't realize this, but it was the only deli that was open. It was the only place to eat.
Oh, okay.
After hours.
All right.
So
okay.
That's why everyone went there.
Right. Yeah.
But I think who was it? Mickey Mantle that married Marilyn Monroe?
Joe DiMaggio.
Was it Joe DiMaggio?
Yeah.
Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe met at Cantor's Deli.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Bob Dylan would hang out there. And Neil Young would hang out there.
All right.
And, yeah, everyone would hang out there because it was the only place to eat after hours.
Right.
So everyone would go
and
back
And it's still there.
And it's still there.
Yeah.
And it's still going strong.
Yeah.
I was there, like, a year ago.
Oh, okay.
Less than a year ago.
Okay.
And Guns N' Roses used to go there and because they'd get free food because Mark would give them food and they'd hang out there. And,
and there's one of those classic early black and white photos where the whole band is sitting in a sofa, which was taken at Cantor's Deli, probably by Mark Cantor. I can't remember, but that book is just amazing. I went through it in a couple hours, just looking at all those pictures. And he's got all the set lists, and he talks about the shows because he recorded everything.
I think he was that, like, he's very anal and a little bit special, and
you kind of get the feeling that he must have known. I mean, thinking that they were like hundreds of bands in LA at that time playing those clubs and trying to make it, but I mean, it must have been something, not just being a friend of Slash's, it must have been something about that band that made him record all those shows. And
well, he said that, and I don't really know how to say this, but Mark is, I've met him quite a few times now, and he's special. He's not calculated or manipulative or out for money.
Right.
He just like really authentically loves his band.
Yeah.
And quite possibly he just knew from the start this was going to be amazing. Yeah. These guys are absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
And luckily for us, he documented it. He had a camera, and these guys, I think, who wouldn't let anyone in there in a circle.
No.
Let this guy in.
Yeah.
And he was a smaller kid, little kid, kind of followed them around.
Yeah.
And, they liked him. Like, his wife ended up doing Axl Rose's and Axl's wife, Erin.
Oh.
He did their hair at their wedding.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Stuff like this.
Nice. But that's actually on YouTube. There's actually a lot of complete shows, both audio and filmed, from the Appetite for Destruction tour from 87, 88. There's a lot of stuff from 86. So there's a lot of treasures on YouTube when it comes to Guns N' Roses. But then you have those classic, the MTV...
Live at the Ritz.
Live at the Ritz. Killer stuff. Absolutely. Love that stuff.
Hey, let's play a bit of music. This is Paradise City. We'll be right back.
Paradise City, Guns N' Roses on Behind the Vinyl, the special Appetite for Destruction. Paradise City, of course, that, I think that was like, that one exploded over here in Sweden when that one came out, and that video was played on MTV every single day. And Nigel Dick said it was well, it was recorded on the 16th of August, 1988, Giant Stadium in New York, when Guns N' Roses opened up for Aerosmith.
I love that video, man.
Yeah, it's I love that song because it, you know, reminds me of summer, or I don't know what it was. And the thing was that they were supposed to where they shot a lot of stuff, where they went to Manny's Music in New York and so on. And Nigel Dick got called up by Tom Sutaut at Geffen, and Tom said that he wanted Nigel Dick to do a video with Rock City Angels. You remember those guys?
I remember those guys, absolutely.
And he wanted him to do the video in Memphis. I don't know if they were from Memphis, whatever. But it was supposed to be done on a Sunday and Monday, and Nigel Dick said, well, you know, I'm going to see Guns N' Roses on Monday and Tuesday in New York and shoot a video for them. And he just said, yeah, I know, but here's the money, you work it out. And he ended up doing Rock City Angels, and Nigel Dick had to tell his cameraman, go with the band around New York City, film as much as you can, and I'll join you Monday night. So all the stuff where they walking around in New York City, the black and white stuff,
great footage,
was, yeah, was done by Nigel Dick's cameraman, because Nigel Dick wasn't there. And then they fly over, there's stuff where you see they get on the Concorde, they fly to England to play Donington.
Yep. Which was that the Donington of the accident?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that same thing, Nigel Dick wasn't there because there weren't enough money. So Nigel Dick had to send the cameraman just to follow around Guns N' Roses. And he had to stay back and go through all the stuff they'd filmed at Giant Stadium. And then, of course, the accident. And the funny thing is that one of the guys that got trampled to death during the Guns N' Roses show, his name was Alan Dick. So Nigel Dick got a lot of phone calls from relatives and family and so on, thinking that it was Nigel that had died.
Whoa.
In that accident, yeah, shortly after.
I've never heard that story.
No,
before.
And he also said that there's like, for a brief moment in that video, and when they're playing Donington, there's a shot of the audience, and he says that there's a face in the audience, you see a guy, and then he just like disappears. And he said Nigel has always wondered if that was one of the guys when the accident happened. But he doesn't really know. But it was a tragic thing.
It was a very tragic thing that was to no fault of the band.
No, not at all.
And not at all. And it was just a bad circumstances.
Yeah.
Two kids, right?
Yeah, two kids.
Two kids lost their life.
Yep.
I think Guns N' Roses, no one told Guns N' Roses what was going on.
No.
Through fear of the crowd rioting if they took the band off stage, if I think. Yeah. But Guns N' Roses just had an amazing show. And the crowd just, they were so, the anticipation was so high, and everyone wanted to see him. The crowd just went crazy.
Yep.
And it was a really muddy, slippery day.
Yep.
And unfortunately, two kids like lost their step and got trampled to death.
Yeah.
And from what I understand, like, Guns N' Roses were absolutely devastated by the news.
I think there's a story. I think I read that not too long ago. There's a story about David Lee Roth in there.
Really?
Yeah, where he met the band after they found out about this, and him being a complete dick.
Yeah. I remember.
Laughing it off, and, you know, kind of having a drink and something. I can't remember what it was.
Having a drink in the bar. Okay, this is just coming to me now.
Yeah.
Yeah, having a drink at the bar at the hotel.
Yeah.
And he went and joined Axl.
Yeah,
who was having
exactly.
And was very upset.
Yes.
And David Lee Roth said, I don't know what he said, but something
stupid,
like, you know what?
Shit happens or something like that.
Shit happens or something like that. Yeah. I don't know what. Yeah. And Axl fucking freaked out.
Exactly.
And, you know?
Yeah.
basically told him to fuck off.
Yeah, yeah.
And everyone has to remember that this is fucking David Lee Roth, everyone's hero.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Back then.
Oh, yeah.
So you've got a band on their debut album.
Yeah.
So, although yeah. Axl Rose is Axl Rose now,
yeah,
he lived this way
yeah.
before he was signed.
Oh,
he
absolutely.
Didn't give a fuck about anyone.
No.
You know?
Det her er Behind the Vinyl på My Rock.
The thing is also that because Guns N' Roses played the UK before, they played in 1987.
Played at the Marquee.
Exactly. I think that at the Marquee is when they played Knocking on Heaven's Door for the first time live.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that show is out there as well. You can listen to it.
I think they had a pretty adventurous time over there, and it was yeah. very debaucherous. And
oh, very, yeah.
Mixed reviews.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think even the album got mixed reviews.
Yep. Yep. Which is funny.
Which is funny.
Yeah. Because yeah. it is. I don't know. It is
near on faultless record.
Yeah.
There's one or two songs which some people have said, eh. Really, that one?
No, but I like them all.
I think they're great.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is that this band could write such an amazing record and selling record, and then following this, they ended up releasing Lies, Lies, Lies.
Yep. You know,
as a bridge
yep.
EP, which I really like.
Yep.
But their next record was Usual Illusions
yep.
1 and 2,
yep.
and some of them. Biggest songs and the best songs, You Could Be Mine,
yep.
Don't Cry,
yep.
November Rain, were all written,
yep.
even Back Off Bitch, were written for Appetite for Destruction.
Exactly.
November Rain wasn't on Appetite because Sweet Child was there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't finished.
Exactly.
to Axl's liking.
Exactly. I remember talking to Vicky Hamilton, the first manager, who said that she remembered they were doing, if it was a show or something, but she just remembered Axl Rose sitting down by a piano and playing November Rain.
Yeah.
And it was just this beautiful, beautiful song. And this was before Appetite, and it didn't end up on the album.
No, no. So My Michelle was it was written about a friend of theirs, you know, who
yes.
struggled with drug addiction.
Yep.
Whose father, I understand, was a porn producer.
Yep. Used to make porn films, or a porn store or something like that.
I had a porn store or something like that. Maybe should have done our research there, but and she was I think supplied the band with some drugs, and she struggled with drugs.
Yep.
Her name was Michelle.
Yep.
And so that song was written about her.
But that's also because that's one of those lyrics that I remember me and my buddy, we were in school, and I remember us, you know, memorizing those lyrics and writing them in school books and so on. And that was something that was totally new as well, that whole thing of it being so real. You'd never listen to something like that before. It starts off with, your daddy works in porno now that mommy's not around. She used to love a heroin, but now she's underground.
That's fucking heavy lyrics, man.
It is,
man.
Really heavy.
Yeah.
You know, that's not the party anthem.
No, no.
But I think that really had an impact as well, because, you know, we'd been listening to, Poison and Motley Crue and whatever, and Rat and all that, and they didn't sing like that. Not in those words.
No, not at all.
So this was something really new, new.
My Michelle, also Sebastian Bach, when Guns N' Roses got back together, he went on tour with them. Their first, whenever that was, 2004, 2005, whenever that got back together, and he would go out on the road and sing that song.
Yes.
My Michelle.
Yep.
And Slash is obviously a Gibson guy through and through.
Yep.
You know, he uses Gibson. He's got his own signature model Gibsons. He recorded Appetite for Destruction with what some people think is a Gibson, but it's pretty well known that it's not. It's a Gibson copy. He'd sold all his guitars for heroin.
Oh, right.
And hocked off a lot of his gear.
Okay.
So he actually had no guitar. So Alan Niven got him a guitar. And it was a copy. I can't remember the name of the guy who made it. But it was a copy of a Gibson Les Paul.
Oh, okay.
Like a 69 Gibson Les Paul.
Right, yeah.
And so he used that to record the majority of the record.
Okay.
The only time he used a Gibson was a Gibson SG, and it was on My Michelle.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Cool.
And it was a 1960 model Gibson SG, which was worth a fortune.
Right.
Which I guess he borrowed or got it from somewhere. He ended up throwing it out of the window of the van just because, for whatever reason. And again, we're not talking a band that sold 100 million records now. No. We're talking a band that had nothing, you know?
So. Dude, there's a picture of... isn't there a picture of Slash standing next to a van with a guitar through the windshield?
Yeah, absolutely. And I got a feeling that that van was actually a rental van they used for a show or something.
Right,
and they trashed it and sent it back.
Okay.
Again, that shit could never happen now.
No.
But back then, it seemed to happen a little bit more.
Yeah. And I remember Vicki Hamilton, of course. I mean, she's got a book out as well. Came out like 2 years ago where she tells the story. But they lived with her, or, you know, Axel lived there, I think. Izzy and Steven or Slash.
Slash
or,
lived there for a while as well.
Yeah. And she said also that when Axel got mad or he threw a hissy fit or whatever, all the others just kind of ran away and hid because he was just like too crazy. And that's a funny story. I remember, I guess it's in Slash's book, whatever, because I remember Slash was on David Letterman or whatever it was. And they talk about different stories. And he talks about how Axel slept on his mother's couch, whatever it was. And then Slash's mother said something about Axel sleeping there. And then Slash and Axel are driving away in a car. And Slash brings this up to Axel that, you know, you can make the bed, whatever, you know, when you'd be sleeping there. And he just answers by opening the door, and he jumps out of the car when they're going down Sunset Street, whatever, like,
oh my God,
30 miles an hour or something. Yeah, that was Slash's story. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty funny.
Which also kind of paints the picture of Axl Rose.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Oh, nuts. Nuts, nuts, nuts.
Alright, should we play another song?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was My Michelle. Let's play... fucking without a doubt the song that really did change it all, Sweet Child of Mine.
Yes. We'll be right back.
Where do we go now? Where do we go?
Klassikere under loop. Behind the vinyl på My Rock.
Sweet Child of Mine, Guns N' Roses. That's also the whole story with that, that Slash was kind of just like fiddling around with that thing. And the others heard it, I think, and then they turned into song.
I think it was Axel. He was upstairs.
Yeah.
And Slash used to use it as a little bit of a warm-up for his fingers.
Yeah.
And then Axel come down and went, hey, what was that?
Yeah.
What was that thing you were playing? And he was like, what? And then they shaped it into a song.
Yeah, that was a massive one.
Massive one. And all of their girlfriends are in that video.
Oh, yes.
All of their girlfriends stroke wives. I think it turned out to be Slash's first wife, Duff McKagan's first wife.
Yeah, Aaron is in there as well, isn't he?
Axl Rose's first wife, Aaron, sorry.
Yeah, Aaron Everly. Yeah.
Yeah, the daughter of one of the Everly brothers.
Exactly, yeah. Wake Up Little
Susie. Yeah, Wake Up Little Susie. And also, what's that song from Ghost? The movie Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore.
Right, yeah. I can't remember now, but yeah.
I think that main song is an Everly brothers song.
Might have been, yeah.
So they're all done. They're all in that.
Yeah.
And that was recorded in a warehouse somewhere in just downtown LA.
Yeah, and around that time must have been like the most played song on MTV.
Absolutely.
Because it was just like 24/7 forever and ever and ever.
Absolutely.
And whenever you turned on the radio, it was Sweet Child of Mine all the time.
Yeah.
And the video.
But there's certain songs, like I was talking to someone about Metallica's Enter Sandman when it came out.
Yeah.
And they were saying, well, that was a departure from Metallica and not all the fans liked it, or not many fans liked it, and blah, blah, blah. I can remember when that came out, everyone was like, it was heavy. It was the only thing heavy at the time.
Yep.
That it just stood so far out. And I think Sweet Child did that as well. It just stood so far out above everything else when it came out.
Recorded in an old dance studio above a bank in LA, which Alan had found that studio, Alan Niven, and they shot it in a day, I believe. And also, it was kind of funny because I asked Nigel Dick if there were like drugs and booze and girls during all those videos they did, but he said that no, nothing really. He really had that as always demanded that there'd be no like drugs or drink or whatever when they were doing videos like that.
Sweet.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think Axl was really the drug guy either.
No, no.
I think he drunk, but I think he protested to the guys.
Yeah.
The guys' drug use.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's the famous show they did for Rolling Stones.
With Rolling Stones? At, supporting Rolling Stones?
Yeah. Where it says that too many have been dancing with Mr. Brownstone, whatever it is. It might be the last show you'll ever see with Guns N' Roses or something like that.
Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah, indeed.
So we kind of got through that record, man, but we're going to... the record ends with a song called Rocket Queen.
Ooh. That was a new thing as well, when you heard that girl moaning.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly, the sexual moans.
Yeah.
Do you know the story behind that?
Yeah, it's Axl, but it's Steven Adler's girlfriend, isn't it?
Absolutely, a girl called Adriana Durgan.
Yeah.
She was a stripper at the time. Yeah. But she was also a really close friend with the guys. She was dating... Yeah. She fed him a lot. She was dating Steven Adler.
Yeah.
But she was also one of Slash's really good friends. And she'd drink a lot with Slash.
Yeah.
And supposedly, they could have used some... like standard sound bites or
absolutely.
Something, you know, like you can buy the news,
yeah.
Or you can buy the music of raindrops, or you can buy the new music of the sounds of sex.
Yeah.
But Axl didn't want that. He wanted it to be real and legit. And supposedly he couldn't, which I didn't know. I just found that pretty recently. He asked other people, because he wanted this in advance.
Yeah.
He knew about this.
Yeah.
And he had even asked Erin, his wife, would you do it?
Right.
And she wouldn't do it.
Right.
So so it was a bit spur of the moment on that night that he's like, let's do this, let's record that.
Yeah.
And she was in the studio. It was in New York.
Yeah.
She was part of the group that had flown up to New York.
Yeah. Right.
Axl and Slash and a couple of others. And so she did it for a bottle of whiskey. I think it was a bottle of whiskey that she could share it with her and Slash. Yeah. And so that's her moaning. On
That's also something you really couldn't get away with today, I think.
No.
Which is also part of that whole street really living it.
Yeah.
It wasn't for show. It wasn't made up. It was really them doing all this stuff, all the drugs, all the drink. All the girls, all of that. It was real. And that thing, that brought a whole different vibe to it as well.
Absolutely.
With Appetite and that band.
Yeah, absolutely.
Just nuts. I remember Nigel Diggs said, because that one was, so he did, the final video he did was It's So Easy.
Okay.
You know, which is like a live shot video from the cat house or whatever it is. And.
Okay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And he said that he showed the band the video, or Slash came in and saw the finished product, and he said, okay, cool, see you later. That was the last time Nigel Dick talked to Slash.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Time flies. Yeah.
Alrighty, and it does. That's
it. Sure,
another behind the vinyl, man. We'll end it and we'll play Rocket Queen. It's good talking to you, man.
Yeah, absolutely the same.
I'm gonna go and play that record now. Are you kind of jonesing to hear that record?
Hell yeah, I'm gonna pour myself a whiskey and I'm gonna listen to Appetite for Destruction.
I love that. Alrighty, man. Catch you guys later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Når man har vendt pladen, og sidste nummer er spillet, så er Behind the Vinyl slut. Tough Love. Darren og Niklas er tilbage næste søndag kl. 16 med endnu et klassisk album. Og indtil da kan du fange denne og alle de forrige episoder som podcast på radioplay.dk/myrock. Adios.